From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. I am John in Colorado and hosting tonight, so you know it's going to be somewhat Hong Kong-based. Joining me tonight is Mr. Hunter Dusing in Texas. Say howdy, Hunter.
I am not a crook.
And returning to the show is co-author of These Fists Break Bricks with Grady Hendrix, making a really cool return to our show for tonight's special occasion is Chris Bojali.
Hello, and Nora Shell. Thank you for inviting me back.
Oh, sure. Well, this episode was a little important and was requested by a listener. Butch Portillo asked us to do this, and I said, well, that's a pretty good idea. Anyway, on April 5th, we lost Jimmy Wang Yu, who is one of the legendary Hong Kong, I guess you could also say Taiwanese cinema stars, but really an international star at one point, kind of created the genre as we know it.
Real trailblazer.
It wasn't Bruce Lee. It wasn't necessarily Five Fingers of Death. It was actually The Chinese Boxer, which was Wang Yu's directorial debut. And that actually established the formula for Kung Fu cinema of the 70s and pretty much most of the 80s, actually. In terms of American martial arts movies, pretty much how they're done today is all really started by The Chinese Boxer. And that was even inspired, as I've been told by fans, it was inspired by some of the Japanese judo karate films of the 60s, which are very hard to see these days. I think I found one of them dubbed in Spanish or French on Facebook, of all things, on a Facebook channel. I think it was a remake of Judo Saga, the Kurosawa film, which that film, if you want to see where the structure of this cinema comes from, it sort of kind of goes back to that, but you can find other sources as well.
The easiest stuff to see are the Sagata Sanshiro films from Kurosawa. Yeah. You know, Criterion has kept those in print, so you can go see those. I think those are kind of cited as a direct influence on The Chinese Boxer and Wang Yu in general.
Yeah. And also a couple of months back, we reviewed Man from Hong Kong, which was Wang Yu's first and I think it was his only international production. That was the Golden Harvest Australia co-production. And you can go back and listen to that episode. We're not going to talk about it here tonight because there's too many other Wang Yu films to discuss. So anyway, to get started, Chris, you know, the fandom in America and probably Europe as well has a tendency to hit, like, it's like Bruce Lee is always this sort of crossroads. It's like it has to be what came before Bruce Lee and what came after Bruce Lee is how we seem to define this genre over here, which I don't agree with at all. Like, I think once you look past that, you start to see more of the truth of the industry and how these films were accepted around the world. You know, the thing is, it's like Wang Yu doesn't get much credit, and people still, you could mention him on something like the Black Belt Face Magazine Facebook page, and it's still, oh, he wasn't as good as Bruce Lee. He didn't have the skills of Bruce Lee. Why is it you think like it's kind of gone in this direction?
Well, there's this, what I always encountered was that, Wang Yu was the big star first, and then once Bruce Lee came along, that was it. Which is really kind of a simple-minded way of looking at it. I mean, he was gone from Shaw Brothers. He was at Golden Harvest at the same time that Bruce Lee was at Golden Harvest, and so maybe there was a little bit of competitive, you know, feelings there, you know, coming from Wang Yu, but I think it was short-lived. Like, I don't, in watching more of his movies and reading more about him, I don't get the impression that that he was too concerned about Bruce Lee at all, really. And Bruce Lee was gone so soon that it didn't matter anyway, really.
Yeah, and if you look at the if you look at his filmography from like 71 to 73, Bruce is alive. He's making a lot of movies. He's not just making movies with Golden Harvest. He's making them in Taiwan. He makes a Zatoichi movie with Shintaro Katsu, which is really, that might be his peak achievement, because that's a terrific movie. It's not like everybody was standing still and waiting to see what Bruce Lee did just because Big Boss is a hit. You know, he was just Chinese Professionals, I think, came out the same year. Or One Arm Boxer, whatever you want to call it now. We're going to be correcting ourselves on these titles frequently tonight. It's just like, and over here, it seems like when his films were released, like I remember I went through my hometown newspaper. I found like some old copies in a closet, and I found one from like 73 or 74. And there was a big ad for The Screaming Tiger, Wang Yu, and I think it was a retitling of Wang Yu King of Boxers or Wang Yu Destroyer. I don't know. I get them confused myself, because they'll have two dubs for these things. They'll have like four or five titles depending on what distributor was passing them around. But he was big, and I would talk to guys who went to the movies back then, and they loved Chinese Professionals, and they saw Chinese Boxer as Hammer of God or whatever, and they said that he was a bad dude. He was, you know, they weren't like, oh, he wasn't as good as Bruce. Nobody talked like that back then. You know, they loved Wang Yu. Like he resonated. And the funny thing is, I showed my son, I couldn't show him the Bruce Lee movies because they're too R-rated, but I figured the Wang Yu movies, well, the gore is a little over the top and goofy looking, he could handle it. He loved him. Wang Yu's his favorite Hong Kong actor, even over Jackie Chan. It's the strangest thing. And I think it's something about a mythic quality of stuff like One Armed Swordsman and Blood of the Dragon. He really likes a lot. That was a favorite of mine when I was a kid, because I think it was the first Wang Yu film I saw. You know, there's something about it. Like, he does appeal to the viewer with no prejudice from previous writings or authors or books or anything like that. So, well, it's, you know,
The cult of Bruce Lee is very much a post-Bruce thing. It's been kind of created in the media. And when you watch documentaries on Bruce Lee, like I Am Bruce Lee, they act like Chinese cinema before Bruce was all wuxia films starring women flying around, spinning around, doing blade attacks and screaming. I remember they pick these clips and make these movies look as horrible as possible.
Yeah, to make it seem like Bruce flight.
Yeah, they're like spinning around going, wah! You know, and it's just, and they're intentionally trying to denigrate the wuxia film to make it seem as though Bruce saved Chinese action cinema. And and like, you know, you look at Wang Yu, and he's in The One-Armed Swordsman, which is one of the, I think that's the first Shaw Brothers movie I saw that I loved. And it's this epic story with suffering. And, you know, you have this hero who loses his arm and he learns this new technique. And it's a fantastic star turn role. It's like the Fistful of Dollars of these movies. You know, it's just so good. It's up that level in my head. But he does a wuxia film that is as grounded and as cool as anything that came in the kung fu genre. And like you were saying, Chris, it's a very simple-minded narrative that kind of the cult of Bruce has spread. And then he goes and does Chinese Boxer and sets this new standard for it. But I think you're right, John, that when you watch Bruce Lee movies, most people who are watching a Bruce Lee movie for the first time have gone through the Bruce propaganda machine.
Yeah.
You know, they're watching the movie because, you know, the dude from Black Eyed Peas told them it was the greatest. He's the greatest movie star.
Kobe Bryant studied Jeet Kune Do. So
yeah, you know, that's the way to go. The way he does hip hop is the way Bruce Lee does martial arts. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Like he learned how, and that Bruce Lee invented MMA. Did you know that?
he invented MMA, and he represented his Chinese culture much in the way the Black Panthers represented.
Yes,
with the fist.
And when I saw One-Armed Swordsman, I had no clue who Jimmy Wang Yu was, but I immediately was like, man, this guy's a great star, you know?
Yeah.
And it's funny because he's not like, he does, like his face is kind of soft. It's very, he's very vulnerable looking. He doesn't look like a particularly what you would classify as a tough guy, but it works.
It does.
And I think he tends to take people by surprise, like your son, perhaps. You know, you go in without prejudice, like you said.
Yeah, he had no prejudice whatsoever, and he kind of got into him. And like any time I got a Wang Yu movie on, he'll watch that, and he's like, you know, he's telling me like Wang Yu is his favorite Hong Kong star. You know, just it's not Jackie, it's not Bruce. You know, it's not anybody goofy, it's not Jet Li, it's Wang Yu. And there's something about his acting ability, which he's not given much credit for, but he's kind of a star in that sort of Steve McQueen kind of mold, the kind of, you know, maybe, I guess a little Bronson, but although he was doing this before Bronson was big, that kind of the loner or the kind of angry young man, but still looks like a, you know, he still comes off like a man. He's not Fu Xing.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, smiling at the camera and at the audience and Mr. Happy-Go-Lucky. He can't play those type of roles.
Yeah.
Although, like, I did discover while I was researching for this show, I went out of my way to watch like more obscure Wang Yu films. And then I discovered one that I had to share with Chris on YouTube called Brotherly Love. And it's a comedy. It's him and Charles Chin, the really handsome guy from Winners and Sinners. And it's, I think it was filmed in 76. And it depicts Wang Yu as, and I haven't watched the whole thing. There's no subtitles. There doesn't seem to be a dub anywhere so far. But it'll have Wang Yu, like he's doing stunt work on a kung fu film. And so he's wearing like the wigs and the long hair and the, like, you know, the Q-tail or whatever. It's like, it's, and he's getting his money, like they're paying him for the day, like they're paying cash out for the day. And so I was like, oh, he's doing comedy. How cool. It's like, we don't really know about this because this part of his career is not really, you know, American fans, they don't, it seems like we're reaching a point where finally the home video fandom, or whatever you want to say, the younger generation is getting into like the Shaw Brothers films and the better indie films. And maybe it's going to open it up to where viewers can start exploring the genre a little more, with a little more, I don't know, a little more depth than we've seen before, where it was always Bruce Lee, Jackie, Shaw Brothers, you know, Jet Li, and then that's it. You know, that's, or John Woo, you know, he gets thrown in there. He didn't make martial arts movies.
And then the label folds because the guy who runs it is going to prison for sexual harassment.
Yeah, as a creep or has a mangina or whatever the hell, harassed every actress in Hollywood.
He molested a ficus plant or something.
Yeah, broke every career, apparently, you know, ended everybody's career. But But yeah, like the label goes under, but now like we've seen the Shawscope box set, which
88 films too. Like,
yeah, 88 films.
We're getting all these.
I was throwing them out.
If my head is spinning because, you know, when back in the 2000s, we were getting the Dragon Dynasty stuff and, you know, these were higher quality than anything we'd gotten. And then it sort of went away. And I remember John and I talking about it, that, you know, the people who collect this stuff are used to pirating it and don't really care about quality.
Yeah.
But it's been another, oh, it's been, you know, 10 plus years, 15 years since then. And now we've gotten, now we're getting these Blu-rays of it. Like, we just got like, I think we got a Blu-ray of like 36 Chambers and that's it, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe some of the Jet Li ones, but now we're getting these box sets and 88 films, and I'm hoping that, okay, maybe we're going to get, and even, you know, this company sucks when it comes to this stuff, but even Criterion is putting out some martial arts movies, you know?
Like, yeah, they announced the Heroic Trio and Executioners.
Yeah, but, you know, it, so we're getting some stuff from a lot of different labels. So, yeah. You know,
respectable labels.
Yeah.
Not public domain, Mill Creek.
Yeah,
bringing up those
George
old
George Tan or whatever.
George Tan bootlegs, gone through 10 generations, and it's the same print that he probably stole off Michael Wirth like 30 years ago. Who knows? You know. But yeah, it's been better. It's definitely been better compared to what it was like 10, 15 years ago, where you had to depend on Bay Logan signing off on something.
Yeah, you have to go to his blog and watch his commentary track.
Yeah. Okay. I'll for, since we have a professional on the show tonight, I'll hold back from the Bay Logan. But yeah, 88 films, Eureka over in England, doing fantastic work.
Yeah, I got their Mr. Vampire
every week they seem to make an announcement that sounds more exciting. It's like, I wouldn't think they'd release that, you know.
Speaking of Wang Yu, they put out, didn't they put out Millionaire's Express?
Yeah, where he plays Wong Fei Hung, because what that was, he plays the father of Wong Fei Hung.
Dad, yeah.
Yeah, and Shaq Ken plays the father of the villain he always played in the Wong Fei Hung movies. And supposedly, I think Kwan Ta King was supposed to play Wong Fei Hung in that movie, but he was filming Aces Go Places 4, so didn't have time to do it. So Sammo got Jimmy Wang Yu to take the role, which was cool. It's a cool, funny role for Wang Yu to play, where he gets some good bits in there. I still got to pick up that Eureka Blu-ray.
Yeah, me too. I was thinking about that, but leading up to this show, that's one I need to go ahead and get.
Yeah, because I have the Hong Kong Legends, but like my shelf of Hong Kong Legends is increasingly worthless because they keep announcing these HD releases of the same thing.
I know,
thing.
Man. Mm-hmm. It's crazy.
It's like, what am I going to do? Nobody wants these things. They're all buying the Blu-rays. I can't donate them to a thrift store because I don't want some bum to like buy these and get all excited, put them in his machine, and this doesn't play in your region, you know.
Right.
I even tried to do a Craigslist or free cycle giveaway of all my region twos, and yeah, nobody bites.
I was looking
film
at
collectors just don't read those sites.
I was looking at my DVD of One Armed Swordsman, and you know, I was going, okay, like if they put out a Blu-ray, you know, it's probably not going to have this interview with Jimmy Wang Yu on the extras.
That's true.
You know, but I love Jimmy Wang Yu because on the Blu-ray, what does he want to talk about? His car. He's like, I was getting 25 a week, but my family bought me a car and I drove it to and from the studio every day. I had
everybody
a car.
Else, David Chang and T Long were taking the bus. Yeah. You know,
he was very proud of the fact that he was driving a car to and from, even though he was getting paid like peanuts. You know,
well, a friend of mine has an astounding collection of 70s Hong Kong movie magazines, and he let me read through the stack one time when I was staying at his place, and there would be like the articles about Wang Yu. They would have these very brief English translations of like maybe one paragraph, although you'd see a whole page of Chinese writing, but it was like one paragraph in English, and it was like, why are you fighting in restaurants, Wang Yu? And I guess he was getting in fights in cafes with people, and I don't know if they were just covering up triad battles or something. And then my friend would also talk to his sister who was over in Asia, and or his family in Taiwan. They would say, oh, Wang Yu got to a fight over a parking spot, you know, last week. And this is like in the mid 90s. So we envisioned him as this old man, just like fighting over parking lots. And like, he would still just get fight at the drop of a hat. So his reputation was pretty crazy. Like I would guess, you know, Bruce Lee, for some reason, people go nuts with the whole, how good of a fighter was he in real life? Well, Bruce had like, I think two known arranged fights, maybe three at best, and the details on him are shaky. Wang Yu, there's like a fight every other day. Like for the peak of Brian Trenchard Smith on the commentary of Man from Hong Kong, he said within hours of Wang Yu getting off the plane in Sydney, he's getting into a fight at a bar. It's just like he's drinking every drink in the bar, and then he's challenging everybody to a fight. Then you hear he almost gets to a fight with Oliver Reed on the set of New Spartan. Chris, what do you know about the New Spartans movie that was never finished or never completed?
They filmed for 10 days and then it was shut down because of money, the funding fell through.
Right.
They had to relocate at one point because of some threats to the cast. Excuse me. So I think they were originally filming in Ireland and then they relocated. I'm not sure where they went after that, but that happened. And then, the situation between, Wang Yu and Oliver Reed. Yeah. There was a lot of drinking going on. The director was Jack Starrett, who was a big drinker. And also, he had cocaine issues. I'm not sure if he had them on that movie,
right?
But he was a notorious coke addict, and there was also a situation with the press being there because there was Patrick Wayne and Susan George were romantically linked at that point. So yeah, there was a lot going on in a short period of time. I think not all of Jack Starrett's usual stunt people could be there, because I mean, there are rules about how many Americans can work on a European production. So I know Paul Knuckles, who is his usual stunt coordinator, was on the film, but a lot of the other stunt people who had worked on like Race with the Devil and some other movies previous to this one were not on the film. But I did talk to Paul Knuckles about it. And there was one major action sequence that was filmed, and it involved it's a hostage situation where like a terrorist group goes into they take a bunch of nuns hostage, and then those it turns bastards. Out right, it turns out that well, this is like a comedy. It's like a Blazing Saddles type like spoof of the Dirty Dozen and like Men on a Mission movies. So these terrorists take these nuns hostage. So this crew that has come together, it's Patrick Wayne, Fred Williamson, Oliver Reed, who's the leader, Toshiro Mifune, Jimmy Wang Yu. I think they disguise themselves as nuns, and they try to sneak into the to rescue, and then but it turns out that the nuns have taken the terrorists hostage for sex, because they're so sex starved that they're like using the terrorists for sex, and they get upset that more nuns are coming in and are going to try to steal the action, so they start shooting at them. So then they have to disguise themselves as priests, I think, and then go in. And oh, more men! Great. So that's how they get in, and it's just ridiculous. But that's the sequence that was at least one of the sequences that was filmed. So you'll see every so often on eBay or in other places online, sometimes like a still of Oliver Reed dressed as a priest with a gun will show up, in an auction or something.
I've seen that. Yeah.
New Facebook profile pic.
And he has his character has one arm.
I think Paul Talbot's posted it a few times.
Yeah, his character is one arm, one leg, and one eye, Oliver Reed. And Wang Yu's character, he's an actor in Kung Fu movies, and his name is, I think, Wang Fu. So they get him, and then Toshiro Mifune is like a samurai who had fought in World War II, and Patrick Wayne's character, he's this like a gas station attendant, I think, named Big Dick McCracken. I forgot
who wrote
what his
the
specialty
script?
Is. Any
idea who wrote the script? Or
yeah, it was Anthony Greville Bell, who wrote Perfect Friday and Theater of Blood. Those are his two big movies. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of fun.
Was there a big studio behind it, or was it just because it was an indie production? It just ran out of financing, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm sure it would have been picked up by Allied Artists or American International, or maybe even a major studio, once it was finished.
Yeah, but if it was good enough, I guess. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the now, Chris, you had told me, because we had discussed this before, but recently an MGM poster for One Armed Swordsman was making the rounds online, and you told me the whole story behind that is MGM actually optioned One Armed Swordsman in like, was it 68 or 69, which would, had they released it, they would have beaten Five Fingers of Death to theaters by 4 years. And that would have been the first Hong Kong Kung Fu film or action film to hit big in the US or to be seen in the US at a large scale.
that's really my that's my feeling more than I, because I've looked all over to try to find something to back that up, and I haven't found anything yet. But I think what happened was One Armed Swordsman was getting so much business in Chinatown theaters, and internationally also, because there were some newspaper articles around 68, 69 that mentioned One Armed Swordsman and just the worldwide box office of that movie. And when you start getting that sort of publicity, and also like when One Armed Swordsman opened in New York, there were ads for it in the mainstream newspapers, which didn't always happen. I mean, it happened in 1973 and 74. You would see ads for like Music Palace and, you know, in the Pagoda sometimes, but usually the Music Palace would show up in the Village Voice because they were showing the Shaw Brothers movies subtitled, and they figured, you know, people who were interested in seeing them dubbed in Times Square or in their neighborhood theater maybe would go to Chinatown to see them. But that was 73, 74. I mean, in 1969, it was pretty rare. It just didn't happen. And there you can see ads for the One-Armed Swordsman in the Daily News, like 1969 when it opened. So it was getting a lot of attention. And anytime something like that happens, you know, like when it happened with the Lone Wolf and Cub movies, when they were doing great business in the Japanese theaters around LA, Columbia Pictures was there. They wanted to put one out. And, you know, so they picked one of them up. So, you know, when that happens, it gets attention from the studios and from anybody who wants to make some money off of something. It's like, wow, right. You know, these ethnic theaters are making money. Well, you know, maybe we should cash in on this. So I really believe that's what happened with MGM. They picked up, or they put a bid on it and had it for a short period of time. And this was right around the time that Tony Anthony made The Silent Stranger.
Yeah.
And this just happened to be right around the time that the new management came into MGM. You know, Smiling Cobra came in, and that was it, and sat on everything. You know, slashed the movies. You know, you've heard the stories about what he did to Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, and
right,
yeah. So, yeah, it's and it happened to Silent Stranger. I mean, Silent Stranger didn't come out until he was gone, and it was a new regime,
right?
So, I think it was probably, and you know, they were doing double features at that time. I mean, they had just put out the first two Stranger movies and on a double bill, and they were still doing double bills at that point. So yeah, I think they probably were going to do a Silent Stranger, One-Armed Swordsman double feature. I mean, it's, I don't know. It maybe seems like a stretch.
They would have called it Eastern's double feature or something like that.
Yeah. something like that. I mean, you try anything, you know. I mean, the spaghetti westerns were so big at that point, you know. Why not, you know, look at a different genre from another country, similar but different.
Right. Well, the funny thing is with Wang Yu, he's more of a base or a crossroads for Hong Kong kung fu films, I think, than Bruce, because if you think about it, he worked with Chang Che in the early days, and later when he was doing his Taiwanese indies, he's working with the Lau brothers before they were, you know, permanent fixtures over at Shaw Brothers. Like, right. He's like, I watched Point the Finger of Death. Lau Kor Yung is playing the other one-armed boxer, or I guess sword knife guy. I don't know how you'd really define it. The other one-armed fighter in the film. Also, the Law Brothers did the choreography on Master of the Flying Guillotine. So he's kind of working with these guys. He works with Jackie and Killer Meteors before Jackie Chan is a big deal, all over the world, or at least in Asia, when he's still like doing the Lo Wei movies that he's always badmouthed. And then like in the 80s, you know, he's working with Sammo Hung in Millionaire's Express, and He did his own attempt at a modern, like, Hong Kong new wave action movie, Clash of the Professionals, where he's like a, I think he plays a private eye or something. I haven't watched it in years, but he's doing his own stunts. He's doing the kind of new wave choreography, you know, the way he could do it in the 80s. Also, like in Wang Yu's, it's called Seaman Number 7 in some markets. It's also called Wang Yu's Seven Magnificent Fights. He's doing a modern action film with guys who were, it was filmed in Japan. And so he's doing fight scenes with the guys in the Japan Action Club. Like the fact, karate teacher from the Street Fighter, his name escapes me, right? Masa Fumi Suzuki, I think might be his name, who was an actual real, I believe, was he Shirenji Kenpo or Gojira? I can't remember. But he might have been Shirenji Kenpo. But yeah, he's doing fight scenes with Sonny Chiba's guys. And he's doing his own stunts. He's doing the whole, you know, he's doing some pretty crazy jumps into the water and everything. So everybody was always like, oh, Jackie Chan's the first action star to do his own stunts. And I'm like, Wang Yu was doing all that crazy stuff in the early 70s, like in 73, when Jackie Chan was, you know, getting his neck cracked by Bruce in Enter the Dragon. It's like, there's Wang Yu doing modern action and his own stunt work and a lot of rough and tumble stuff. So he's kind of a pivotal figure, I think, for the genre as a whole. And everybody acts like he didn't have hit movies after Bruce's death for some reason. But I looked on a box office chart one time and Master of the Flying Guillotine was like the top kung fu film that year in Hong Kong. Well, in like, I think 75, 76.
I'm convinced that movie was a massive influence on video games.
Sure.
I think like Street Fighter 2 would not be the game it was without that film. Like, even like the Indian guy stretching his arms and like you smacking people from across the room. Like that's straight out of Master of the Flying Guillotine. Yeah, I think that his films are hugely influential outside of movies. But one thing about Chinese Boxer, because I watched that one for the first time recently. And one thing I noticed about it is it's a Shaw Brothers film. It's a kung fu movie. But it doesn't feel like all the Shaw Brothers movies I've seen. Like I've seen a lot of the Chang Che stuff, the Lau Kar Long stuff, you know, King Boxer, you know, slash Five Fingers of Death, whatever. I've seen a lot of that stuff. But this one, it had very, it kind of, the editing felt more like 80s Hong Kong editing, where it's like, you know, you're getting these quick cuts. I didn't see a lot of the Shaw lot. A lot of it felt like it was shot on location, like, outside, you know, like I just
right,
and like he's punching people and like blood is shooting out of their mouth and he's like you know, it just it felt like a different animal. And you know, I'm not as well versed in these movies as y'all are, but it just it stood out to me, you know. I don't know if I just haven't seen enough or if that's characteristic of that film.
I think there was a lot of influence coming from Japanese movies, in Wang Yu's films, whereas I don't think so much from the other Shaw Brothers filmmakers, maybe after Chinese Boxer, but Wang Yu was a big fan of Japanese movies, and he really liked the Zatoichi movies. I mean, it was a big kick for him to be in one, to co-star with Shintaro Katsu in a Zatoichi movie. But he liked those a lot. He liked the probably going to mispronounce this character's name, but Tang Sazen or Sazen, who was a one-eyed, one-armed swordsman who was the lead character in a number of movies and I guess some popular fiction in Japan. Tetsuro Tamba had played him in the mid 60s, and then Hideo Gosha had made a movie in the mid 60s called Secret of the Urn, which was about Tang Sazen. So there were a lot of these movies being done at the time. And so you see like the one-eyed, one-armed swordsman from Japan kind of becoming the one-armed swordsman of Jimmy Wang Yu. And also he had made a movie called for Shaw Brothers called Magnificent Trio with Lo Li, which is a remake of Three Outlaw Samurai.
Yeah.
And that was made, I think, in 66. That predates One Armed Swordsman. And then, as you mentioned, I think before we started recording or right at the beginning, about the influence of the judo movies in Japan. And that's what inspired him to do Chinese Boxer, were these, going back to Kurosawa's first movie, were these like judo versus jujitsu or judo versus karate films. And that was really, that was an instance where, where Wang Yu went to the Shaw brothers and said, we should do these type of films. They're really popular in Japan. I'm seeing them here. Because there were a number of remakes of Sanshiro Sagata that were done in the mid 60s. I think some under that title and then some that were like unofficial. In fact, Sonny Chiba had done one for Toei in like 1964 or 65, which was like loosely based on that story.
Yeah. And I know that Sega, they had a whole ad campaign. It was Segata Sanshiro, and they would do these commercials where Segata Sanshiro is like taking people and throwing them and they explode.
Well, his movies were popular in Japan because I would go on CD Japan frequently to see what was being released. The only actors that consistently had their movies released on DVD in Japan were Jackie, of course, and Wang Yu. Like Wang Yu, like there was a box set, and I ordered One Arm Boxer, Chinese Professionals from Japan before. That was the first country where it was released on Blu-ray, and it was English friendly, and then it had the old English dub, because there was second English dub recently that was put on it when it was on Amazon Prime, which was like painful to listen to.
That one's getting an Arrow release very soon.
Yeah.
Like I think before the end of the month, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, and I considered it, but I paid so much for that Japanese Blu-ray. I almost like, I can't spend another dime getting another Blu-ray. It's like, that was one of the purchases that forced me to get an all-region Blu-ray player. Because suddenly that film had come out and the Terrence Hill, Bud Spencer stuff was coming out in Germany for like $6 a pop back when shipping was really cheap on Amazon International, and yes, amazingly, and so it's like, okay, these are the only countries taking this stuff seriously. Of course, now we're getting Wang Yu on Blu-ray in America kind of almost every month now, which is strange,
bizarre.
I don't even know how to comprehend it these days. Last year I made a joke about a Joseph Kuo Blu-ray box set would never happen, and then a month later it was announced. It's like meme magic, Hunter. I meme this into reality on the show.
All you have to do is buy these and import them and they'll come here.
Yeah, exactly. It's the collector's curse.
All I have to do is wait.
And like I'm hoping, okay, maybe they'll get around to putting out something like Furious Slaughter on Blu-ray, or one I watched over the weekend, Point Finger of Death, would be nice too, because there's a Taiwanese DVD that I'm not going to order because it's not English friendly. In fact, Yes Asia actually states this is not English friendly. There's no don't bother, Kuai Lo. So I watched The Brave and the Evil, which was a Taiwanese production he made in 71. It's action-packed. It's really fun to watch. There's a print on YouTube in widescreen with subtitles. As of this recording, as soon as the word gets out, I'm sure it'll get pulled. But it's a really cool movie. As far as I know, it didn't get an English release. I stated this on Facebook. And then one of my friends who's a collector says, there's actually two English dubs of that have turned up in bootleg form. And I'm like, two? And he says that the weird thing is one of the English dubs is from like the late 70s, because it uses, I think, the dub team that did like the Godfrey Ho movies or something. So is what he implied. I haven't seen these prints for myself, but the movie's pretty enjoyable. It's very action packed, so you don't get too bogged down in nonstop dialogue or twists and turns like a King Hu film where people are changing their loyalty and you try to follow it in the subtitles. That could get a little baffling, I think, for Western viewers. But yeah, there's a lot of these really cool films. And what stunned me about The Brave and the Evil is it has better production values than most of what he made for Golden Harvest. Because I watched a tattooed dragon. Oh, son. I forgot how cheap looking that movie was. That looked like it was shot in Loewe's backyard. Mm-hmm. I think that was his German Shepherd. That I think that movie's only really remembered for being an early on-screen role for Sam Hui of the Hui brothers. And he's in the film with Sylvia Chang before a few years before they made Aces Go Places together. And but that movie is a rough watch. It is not good. And I was like, why are his Taiwanese films so much more enjoyable than this Golden Harvest movie he made for Loewe? So I was like, I'm thinking, was Golden Harvest a far more of a cheapskate company than we've been led to believe by Golden Harvest themselves? You know, was it like this sort of cheap backyard New World Pictures type outfit that just somehow signed Bruce Lee and had King Hu under contract for a while? It makes you wonder. And they were just lucky to get Wang Yu. But seriously, his Taiwanese movies from that era look way better than his Golden Harvest movies. It's so strange.
Yeah. I have a question for Chris.
Mm-hmm.
So I rewatched Return of the One-Armed Swordsman the other day.
Mm-hmm.
I watched both of them again. And I remember, but when I watched Return of the One-Armed Swordsman, I decided to watch the dub that's on the Dragon Dynasty DVD.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like it was made back in the, you know, late 60s, early 70s. But it is a dreadful dub. Like the dub for One-Armed Swordsman that's on the Dragon Dynasty disc is excellent.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff, classic, you know, love it. Nice on the ears. This one sounds like it was done by people who don't speak English. And I was wondering if you had any insight on that, because I was asking John about it. And he was like, I don't know, maybe it was done in the Philippines or something. But it was a terrible dub. Like it really, I was like, I didn't like it as much this time around, but I think the dub was why.
I don't know where the dub was done, but it's possible that it was done years later and mm-hmm. not done in the late 60s or early 70s. That one was sold to TV. I mean, that returned in the late 80s. I remember seeing that pop up on TV stations, but that was not part of the first One-Armed Swordsman was in the last of the World Northall black belt packages, which was sold to so few cities that I think it was maybe in five cities tops, as opposed to like the earlier ones, which were all over the country, like LA and Miami and a couple of other cities got that fifth one. But the One-Armed Swordsman was in that package. The sequel was not. So some other company got that for TV, but it was on TV around the same time. Like I remember seeing that around 1990. And so because of that, I think the dub was maybe done years later.
Okay.
And by, I'm not sure who would have done that. But I heard, I think, you know, because I mentioned Tony Anthony a little while ago, there's a Tony Anthony movie that has the worst dubbing I've ever heard. It's Pete Pearl and the Pole, which is this gangster movie he made in the mid 70s. And I think it was like, it sounds like film students who were doing it as a project. like football players, university football players taking a film project dubbing this movie. It's that bad. So and there were, I've heard some of the worst dubbing done in the 80s. So another one, it was a movie that used to show up on Joe Bob's movie channel program called Strangler versus Strangler. That has a terrible dub also. So I probably it was like this canon movie that was so bad they couldn't release it to theaters. And I think the dub is just miserable. And so I think probably that Return of the One-Armed Swordsman dates to the 80s.
Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
That's my feeling. Yeah.
It's bad.
Wow.
Yeah.
I would have never guessed that I didn't even know that made television. I thought Shaw Brothers had an exclusive deal with World Northall, and that was going to be where it ended. But wow.
Yeah, no, when World Northall stopped or shut down, I mean, they didn't even go out of business. They just closed. You know,
right.
There was no bankruptcy or anything. I mean, the family that owned the company just shut it down. And so I don't know, like, what happened to the to some of the movies that they had, or if they had that one and then gave it to another company. I'm not sure, but it was making the rounds briefly around that time. And you know, some of the Golden Harvest things were also, you know, in TV packages around that time. But you know, you mentioned how popular Wang Yu was, and his movies seem to always get released in the US, like through, you know, a good 10-year period there from, you know, the first, well, I mean, if you could go back to the Chinatown you know, films, because there was a brief period where some of those, like the One-Armed Swordsman, were playing in like midnight shows, excuse me, in theaters like in New York and LA, and they were being advertised as Chinese samurai movies.
Right, right.
So, you know, like One-Armed Swordsman. So like during the day, there was a theater in New York called the Bijou that was a Japanese cinema. And like some of these theaters, they would run Japanese movies all day. And then maybe at midnight, they'd show like Come Drink With Me or
right.
One-Armed Swordsman. And they would be, you know, Chinese samurai movies, they would advertise them as.
Well, it's the only way they could sell them, I guess, terms people would understand.
Yeah.
It's also like, I was thinking like Blood of the Dragon. Mm-hmm. That has a curious history, because there's a different dub if you watch the Ocean Shores videotape when it was titled The Desperate Chase, but mm-hmm. apparently it was bought very early during the boom. And it was funny. It was at Atlanta, Georgia company run by the Porn King. And right. I guess he was sort of at least pretending to go legit. It has a really cool new soundtrack by a group called Flood. I think they were supposed to be a big deal. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like really neat prog rock. I'll have to, when Hunter gets back on, I'll have to mention that to him. Mm-hmm. Also, it's like they put a new dub on it. William Deal, later the author of Sharky's Machine and Hooligans and a bunch of sleazy bestsellers, Chameleon and some other, Tie Horse, I think that was another one I read.
Primal Fear.
Yeah, did he like, he's listed as associate producer. Did he like rewrite the dub script possibly?
He did, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he did a rewrite on that. Mm-hmm.
Interesting, because it's got pretty good dubbing and pretty good dialogue for a dub job like that. And that was actually the first Wang Yu film I saw on USA Network's Kung Fu Theater. They didn't even cut the blood out of it, so it was really cool to see. And I remember just being baffled by it, like, was this band Flood? What, who's this band? You know, and all that mm-hmm. stuff. It's got a cool soundtrack, and boy, I'd love to see a CD release of it, or at least I guess these days MP3. You know, there I am talking like a boomer, but Hunter would want the original red vinyl for that. Yeah, Hunter, have you seen Blood of the Dragon?
No, I have not.
Okay, Blood of the Dragon was a Wang Yu film called Desperate Chase, where he played a variation on his Silver Spear character. I think he's actually called Silver Spear in the movie, and or White Spear or something like that. And when this company in Atlanta, Georgia, bought the film to distribute it, they put a new soundtrack on it by this Atlanta, Georgia rock group called Flood. So it has this really cool, like, it's like a prog rock soundtrack or something. Like, I think you could probably watch the movie on YouTube.
I'm mm-hmm. all about it.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I think you'd love the soundtrack, if anything. And yeah. William Deal, who later wrote Sharky's Machine, actually wrote the new dub script for it. It was like, it was given a second dub in America, like to give it a more polished dub.
And what's it called again?
Blood of the Dragon.
Blood of the Dragon.
Yeah.
Check that out.
The Hong Kong video version is called Desperate Chase, which is, I think, is the original title. And that is not the version to get, you know.
I'm pretty sure
for me to say that.
I'm pretty sure that like the people who dubbed Blood of the Dragon were Atlanta talent. And there's it's possible that like Ben Jones and some other, you know, if you watch a lot of Southern movies or Atlanta shot, movies, that other actors and actresses who turn up in those, because, you know, William Deal had made a couple of movies in the early 70s, like these like R-rated sexploitation movies.
I always forget that. Yeah, he did work in the industry back then.
Yeah, he was a journalist and a photographer for the Atlanta newspapers, and he got into indie filmmaking. That's how he was connected with Michael Thevis, the porn king of Atlanta, really the porn king of the South. I mean, he had so many of those stores and you know, peep shows and everything, magazine shops that he controlled, and he had produced Poor Pretty Eddie, which was also filmed in the Atlanta area. And a couple of other movies. There was a Western that I know, think Eric and Mike. I think they just recently did an interview with David. It was a David Wirth movie, I think, because David Wirth had shot Poor Pretty Eddie. Uh-huh. And he made a Western that Thevis had produced or invested in. I think Eric and Mike Malloy were shooting interviews with people who were involved with that recently. But anyway, yeah, I think there was some Atlanta talent, perhaps some of the people who were in those movies in supporting roles, and the farmer.
Yeah, right.
Maybe showed up in as voices in Blood of the Dragon. And Flood, they were signed to Thevis's to his recording company, because he had a record company. I mean, he had his hands in so many different businesses, right, business ventures. And I think he was supposed to, they were going to be flying to Hawaii to record an album. They didn't make it to the plane because they heard that he had been arrested.
I thought you were about to say, oh, he just been killed in his driveway escaping from prison or something like that. Because right. It's got a crazy history. How much of that story is in These Fists Break Bricks? Because I think you mentioned it a few times.
We tell what happened about him, you know, escaping, or he blew up a competitor. They blew up his car, and so I think his former business partner left to start his own porn empire. Or he was a bodyguard for him or something like that. He blew him up, and then he escaped from prison, and he walked out of prison. It wasn't even an escape.
They left the door open.
More or less. I mean, he had health issues, and he put in for a transfer to a medical facility, and then he walked out, and he was like on the run for like a year and a half or something like that. And he gunned down one of the people who testified against him. Yeah. I'm surprised that a movie hasn't been made about him. I mean, it would be so sleazy, but still.
Yeah. Well, here's my pitch for like a Alamo Drafthouse type thing, is we reunite Flood and they do the score of Blood of the Dragon live.
Yeah.
Like kind of like how, what's his name's been doing with Goblet and Suspiria, because I went to that a while back, and that was actually cool to see live. I said, back together.
At the Texas Theater, like, they'll get Claudio Simonetti's, whatever his version of Goblet is, to come in and do live, you know.
Yeah, that's who I saw. Yeah, he was, it's funny, he talks just like Eric Zaldivar's impression of Italian people that he does mockingly on our show. Because he was, Claudio is kind of like, hey, you're like a George Romero, eh? Well, he's a score I do for him. And then they did like Two Evil Eyes or whatever the hell it was, you know. It's just like, oh man, you're like a horror movie. You know, he's just everything. We always make fun of Italians for being. But I think we should get a Flood reunion going, and they do the soundtrack of Blood of the Dragon live in the theater, create a new following for that film. Because it's pretty cool. I'd love to see that.
I just found it on YouTube. It has German title cards though.
My DVD is from Germany, because that was the only country that released it in widescreen. It is a public domain staple, but they did have the Michael Fevis soundtrack with the flood music and the new dub. And, you know, probably, as Chris said, these voice actors who were probably later on the sketch comedy show Tush on WTBS that Bill Tush did in 1980. I'm sorry, Hunter, that's around your, just before you were born. Sorry, this is old Gen X knowledge here. But yeah, I think Blood of the Dragon's terrific. It's kind of, it's almost like that Shogun Assassin effect years before Shogun Assassin, like kind of have that kind of weird prog rock music score, give it a fresher dub, and William Deal rewriting the dialogue. I wish more of the movies got that type of treatment. It would have been really cool.
You know, and like that was, you know, you watch Italian horror films, like getting prog dudes to do those soundtracks, you know, Goblin, Keith Emerson was doing horror movie soundtracks, you know, shoving knives into his keyboard.
Yeah,
that were given to him by Lemmy.
There is that sort of connection.
Yeah, Lemmy was a roadie for the Nice, and he gave Keith Emerson Hitler Youth knives. He goes, if you're gonna stick knives, use some serious stuff. And he like gave him Hitler Youth knives. I was like, Lemmy was obsessed with that crap, even when he was just a roadie.
Well, it's funny because when I got my first video copy of Master of the Flying Guillotine, I got it from Sinister Cinema like in 1990 when they briefly offered it or whatever. And when I heard that soundtrack, I thought the soundtrack is, of course, stolen krautrock from Kraftwerk and Neu and maybe a couple of other bands that I can't recall. I thought it was an original score for the movie because I was like 18 or 19 at the time. I was just like, oh man, this is cool. This is the coolest original score for a kung fu film ever. This is like, they should release a soundtrack. And then I think Mike Weldon put in Psychotronic video like a year later. He had identified all the tracks, or somebody identified them for him, or I think that was his thing anyway. So he said, oh, this is music from Neu and Can and Kraftwerk. And I was like, oh, damn. So I like spent forever trying to collect that music to kind of, I'm going to eventually piece together the Master of the Flying Guillotine soundtrack, you know, for my own personal use. But yeah, that's apparently krautrock and prog music was very popular in Hong Kong at the time for them to use that as a score. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Well, the, is it what's the movie that Hapkido, right? Is that's the one that uses Tarkus by
Emerson,
Palmer?
Golden Harvest did not hide their soundtrack theft. Their music theft was not well hidden. Shaw's at least were smart enough to sign a deal with DeWolf. Golden Harvest just stole whatever they feel like stealing. I mean, I know I'd hear like Bernard Herrmann's score for Golden Voyage of Sinbad in some of their movies, and you'd hear like these weird, odd things would pop up. It's like, wait, was Frankie Chan, who was their music guy, I think at the time, it's like he just went out and just stole, went through a record bin and just, oh, okay, this will sound good. You know, we'll steal this and put it on a movie that's being released around the world. But, yeah, the fascination with like prog rock and all that stuff. I think Hunter, the more of these you watch, I think you're going to be pretty amazed by.
People great forget digging
they did.
You know, that stuff fell out of fashion so quickly that I think people forget how big that music was. Mm-hmm. You know, that prog was huge, and they were taken very seriously as like serious musicians that were taking rock to college and. You know that these guys are classically these are the new classical musicians. You know, like Rick Wakeman. You know, with his Vangelis. You know,
Rick Wakeman's always seen with the cape. Doesn't he always have like the?
Yeah.
Is he the one with like the Count Yorga cape with the huge like?
I believe so. He had like, you know, he dressed.
He plays his piano like.
Yeah, and like he was in Ken Russell's List of Mania dressed as Thor from the Marvel comics.
Ah.
And Vangelis would like have himself photographed with like a bow and arrow, like in robes and stuff like that. And he had the giant keyboards. And when they tried to get him to join Yes, and when they introduced him to Steve Howe, they were like, you know, Steve Howe, a guitar player. And he goes, not a real instrument. So it didn't go over too well.
Yeah, you're in for a surprise when you watch some of these and you start recognizing the obscure obscure tracks and everything. It's kind of fun if you're a music buff. Watching a lot of the early 70s Hong Kong films can be quite a trip.
Yeah.
And the Taiwanese movies as well. So
did they seriously just drop Tarkus on the
Yeah,
it's in the trailer too.
Yeah. Hop Keto's getting released. I think Eureka's putting it out later this year. So which I was laughing about because that is a peculiar dub case where I guess they shot it under the title, was it Chris Lady Kung Fu or something like that? And it seems like every time in the film when they say, apparently somewhere along the lines of post-production or maybe a re-release, they decided Hop Keto was a good marketing term, I guess, because of the Billy Jack movies. So they had
to say Billy Jack.
Yeah. So every time a character said Kung Fu in the film, like, I'm going to go learn Kung Fu, it's redubbed as you just hear this voice come in that's not one of the regular dubbers. Hop Keto. Well, I'm going to go take a lesson in Hop Keto. Sister, you've been taking Hop Keto. So, it's really bizarre. So it makes, hopefully, they restore that for the Eureka Blu-ray because that's the only way to watch it.
Yeah, they didn't really know what to call it either, like when it came to the US, because it was at one point they were going to call it Hong Kong Hellcat. So there are trailers around which are just like the Lady Kung Fu ones, only instead of when they would say, you know, Lady Kung Fu, they'd say Hong Kong Hellcat through the whole but then they flash on the title Lady Kung Fu in the trailers. hadn't made up your mind yet when you cut this trailer together, right?
Right. Well, they probably didn't have time to do like marketing research like they do now.
Yeah.
Where you know you'll get these anonymous emails and stuff just like, hey, does this sound like a good title? That sort of thing. So it's like, so I think it was definitely a test market thing. Now, one of his best movies at Golden Harvest was Beach of the War Gods. Mm. And you told me that actually got a limited release. Was it in Philly? Like it got a brief release.
That I don't know. I know it played, you know, Chinatown theaters, and it got a big release in Hawaii, but I don't know about getting a dubbed and theatrical release. Yeah, that I'm not sure about. But the thing about Beach of the War Gods is that's the first movie where he's billed as Jimmy Wang Yu, but in Australia, because he was in Australia filming The Man from Hong Kong when Beach of the War Gods opened there.
Right.
And they had decided that they were going to bill him as Jimmy on Man from Hong Kong. So when Beach of the War Gods opened, they said, well, let's start it now with this one. We'll call him Jimmy Wang Yu. And
right.
So that's, I guess, technically the first one where he was billed under that name.
Yeah. And some prints that you'll see, what we used to call the Chinatown prints, the original Hong Kong prints, he's credited in English as Jimmy Wang. They don't even go for Wang Yu. So it's like, it's pretty cool. Now, one, myth that I want to get out of the way. A lot of people think, because of old fanzines back in the day, that when Jimmy Wang Yu left Shaw Brothers, like it was so bitter that the Shaws named an actor Young Wang Yu to get back at him. That's a total myth. The names are actually pronounced completely different in Mandarin. So that's just a total myth. Let's end that right now. Young Wang Yu was an actor who worked on Lock Our Lung movies and other Shaw films in the 70s and 80s. But no, it was not named that to get back at Jimmy Wang Yu. Let's get the American ideas out of the way. But they're pronounced totally different in Mandarin, as was confirmed by a friend of mine who speaks Mandarin. So, okay, solve that myth right now. But Jimmy Wang Yu, he made an appearance in New York like 7 or 8 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Were you there that night? I know Grady interviewed him.
Yes.
I did read that interview. And it was the best interview I'd seen with him in English. Probably the only printed interview I'd ever seen with him in English. So, you know, but it was pretty damn good. It was very informative. But apparently he had thrown his money in to shopping malls and restaurants, and he'd seen a lot of his businesses fail. He was kind of like, you know, he sounds like he was kind of an alpha. He was one of those guys who could lose all his money one night. He was a millionaire the next week. He was that type of personality.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I believe the YouTube, the, the stage appearance or the Q&A is still on YouTube. I think you got to do a little digging, but you can still find it on there. And that's where he told the story of getting into a fight with Oliver Reed, because Oliver was picking on, according to Jimmy, Oliver Reed was picking on Jack Starrett, and Jimmy said, hey, instead of picking on him, why don't you fight me? And then they got into it, and he said he was glad that they broke up the fight, because I think he thought one of them was going to be in the hospital, the other was going to be in jail, because I guess they really did not like each other. So, and Oliver Reed was known to start that type of crap with almost every actor he worked with. So props to Jimmy for sticking up for him, or, you know, sticking up for Jack Starrett. You know, I know he's got the bad rep because of that Australian documentary about the exploitation stuff. Oh, Jimmy was racist. Jimmy was this, Jimmy was that. He probably was, but just the fact that he stuck up for Jack Starrett and was willing to fight Oliver Reed, he's okay in my book,
and,
no matter
and
how bigoted he was.
The business with Jackie Chan and the triads.
Yeah, I mean, he did stick up for Jackie Chan. He saved Jackie's ass, because Jackie, Chris, do you want to explain that story? Or?
Well, it had to do with the Lo Wei, right?
Jackie right. Leaving, yeah, Lo Wei. Right. He leaves Lo Wei's company, signs with Golden Harvest. One story was they actually sent him to LA for a year under the official word was he's learning English so he can make the big brawl. Oh. And it was actually to keep him away from all the triad hitmen that Lo Wei was allegedly sending him after him. Now, this doesn't mean he's going to get shot in a drive-by. This means a couple of thugs are going to beat him up with pipes or and bats or your broken bottles, whatever the hell, maim him and make him unfilmable for the young master.
Make him trip on the set of Armor of God.
Right. Fall out of a tree, you know. So apparently they needed to get this business settled. They needed Jackie to make movies in Hong Kong, you know, hassle free. So Jackie goes to Jimmy Wang Yu, who he'd been friends with since Killer Meteors. And Jimmy said, I'll settle this. Because Jimmy had worked with Lo Wei on many, many movies. And supposedly they had this meeting at a restaurant. How Michael Cimino is this? They had a meeting with a restaurant. And of course, the legend goes, there was a fight. But whatever the result of it was, Lo Wei was going to leave Jackie alone after that. So, you know, that was the whole thing. And Jackie owed Jimmy Wang Yu two movies, I believe. One was Fantasy Mission Force. So if you're wondering why Jackie was in that, looking like he just got off the plane in his big brawl outfit. And he's in Fantasy Mission Force, which is this kind of Naked Gun, Zucker Brothers style of Taiwanese comedy spoof of action films. It's really fun. A lot of fans on Facebook hate it. Mm-hmm. I mean, they really hate it. They get mad if you say you like this movie. I love it. I think
it's fun. Yeah.
It is so fun. It is a hoot. I got a German Blu-ray that just looks great. I just think it's the greatest. But you mentioned that you like that film and people think you're crazy because they have no sense of humor about this stuff.
And these are the same people, I'm sure, who will say that Shang-Chi is the greatest American-made martial arts.
Oh, my God. Dr. Craig Reed said that and therefore killed any credibility he ever had when he stated that. I was mocking that today on the
I saw that article pop up again. I was going,
I was like, oh, my gosh. Oh, you, Dr. Reed, you boomer. Time to retire, buddy. But then he made the second film was Island on Fire, which was, what was it called over here? The Prisoner or something on video here.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that. That was
chopped up version. It's not a good movie. It's from the same director as Fantasy Mission Force, I believe. Jimmy Wang Yu has a role in that as sort of a cell block kingpin, I guess. His performance, despite the presence of Andy Lau, Sammo Hung, and Jackie Chan, and Jackie has a couple of fight scenes and nothing great. The best thing about it is Jimmy Wang Yu is the cell block kingpin. He's terrific in the film. He's the only reason to sit through it. The Columbia DVD version or Sony DVD out completely mangles the film, and you don't even appreciate that aspect because it just has a dub and it's a murky print and everything. But Jimmy's performance is the best thing about it. Obviously, he had made all those guys work on the film. They owed him favors. And then he's just, okay, because I got to show off my acting style one more time. And but it's not a recommended movie. It rips off stuff from Bad Boys, The Longest Yard, and The Wild Geese. Somehow they ripped off the ending of The Wild Geese in the film. It's like, you know, Taiwanese filmmakers could be nuts like that. But recently, or actually quite a few years ago, Wang Yu sort of made a comeback in movies where he's the villain in the Donnie Yen film Dragon, which was a remake of History of Violence done as a kung fu film. And Wang Yu, again, best thing about the film, because once he's on screen, he's got that, I mean, he's all old and they got him made up all ugly looking and everything. He's got the scariest screen presence in that film. He blows Donnie Yen off the screen. I think Wei Ying Hung is also in the movie. And, you know, it just nobody compares to Jimmy White, just eating up the scenery and just got a snarly look on his face the whole time. It's a terrific performance, great villain performance. And the only reason I really sit through the movie, it's not that, it's not so hot, but I mean, it's based on History of Violence. Come on. but yeah, it's like, he's really good in that. And I think his last film was like a horror film called Spirit or something. I've got a bootleg of it somewhere on my stacks, but I haven't watched it yet. But he has a very interesting career. It's not just, you know, swinging his arms and stabbing 1,000 people or beating up everybody in a 3-mile radius of some Chinese village. Like, he's got a lot of cool films and a lot of cool work. And like, when I discovered that Brotherly Love movie on YouTube, I can't understand a word of it, but it's pretty interesting to watch just to see him do, hey, he's playing a normal guy who's laughing and, you know, just kind of happy go lucky a little bit. Mm-hmm. He actually smiles in the movie. What do you know? But, but yeah, he's a pretty cool cat. And, it's unfortunate, I guess, in recent years, what was the thing? He had a stroke and then he was recovering in a hospital for the last couple of years from the stroke. And then his daughter was taking care of him. And, you know, he just passed away. I mean, lived a long life. He was a tough guy. Back when they had to be tough guys, I think, to be a lead in these type of things, stand up to triads or trying to get a little money out of you or protection rackets. I think he was considered a die-low, I think, at one thing, but I don't know if we'll ever see honest reporting on that because I think, yeah, pretty much he was a mob boss, kind of like Charles Hung, who was another one who is an admitted head of a triad in Hong Kong. I forget what it's called, but oh well, you can read up on that if you want to dig that deep.
Yeah, when he was in New York for that, I guess it was the New York Asian Film Festival. They had tried to bring him earlier, and there was some issue with his passport. Mm-hmm. So when they got him here in 2014, November of 2014, Grady got a look at all of his paperwork, his passport and his IDs and everything. And so that's why in the book, his name is spelled W-O-N-G.
Wong. Yeah.
And whereas, you know, I didn't really have a problem with that, but I was, you know, do we really want to put that in, you know, we have all these posters and all these ads, everything has Wang Yu, but we're spelling it Wang Yu. I just thought, you know, but we came to the decision to leave it that way because Grady said, look, he threw me against the wall at one point. He said, I don't want to piss him off. This is the way he wants his name spelled. We're going to put it. And it was the first time I had heard that story. Cause I was there when he was interviewing him and, you know, Wang Yu signed my Master of the Flying Guillotine poster. And it was really cool. But yeah, they were horsing around. He was telling Grady stories about fights that he had just been in, because that's what he wanted to talk about, were all these fights. And he had been in a fight like within a few weeks of his appearance there. And he was still, he was still pissed off about it. He said, you know, the police came in and they used tasers. That's really unfair.
How am I supposed to beat up the cops if they have weapons?
Right. And he adds like some kind of a cane with like a knife that came out of it. And yeah, so he was like pulling it out and like, you know, playing, you know, he's playing around, but he's
like
was
a
like,
Sherlock Holmes. Oh, yeah, is he Professor Moriarty? Right.
Yeah, he's doing Baritsu or whatever.
But he threw Grady against the wall at one point and had him pressed up against the wall. So he's like, I'm spelling his name the way it's on the paperwork, the way he prefers. Okay.
So what are you going to do? Wow. Yeah, it's.
You mentioned Island of Fire. I still have the tape that I bought from Garo like
oh, 30, no.
30 years ago at a like a Fangoria show from the like Laserdisc or
yeah. Whatever. Yeah, yeah, because he only sold tapes directly taken from the Laserdisc.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. And yeah, I forgot there was a laser of Violent Death Fire. Boy, I should have saved it. It was probably still the best print of it ever released on video. If you needed a reference copy for Wagyu's performance, because I think I saw one of those Taiwanese bootlegs that went on forever, you know, because the Taiwanese copies were always like, they call them director's cuts. They were really like rough pre-release cuts. Mm-hmm. But the Taiwanese would always put stuff out on tape that was longer than what we got it out of Hong Kong or an American release. But that Island of Fire just went on and on. It's like watching Oklahoma. It's like watching Oklahoma with Chinese guys stabbing each other and killing each other.
And, you know, I suppose we should bring up the, you know, Zatoichi and the One-Armed Swordsman, the other cut of that.
There's two versions.
Will that ever see the light of day? It was made. It was released.
I know that when Tarantino was running that that company Rolling Thunder Films for Miramax, his guy Jerry Martinez had asked Garo, do you know where the ending is, where that Chinese ending is, because in Japan they don't have it. And so Garo asked me, and I think I said, well, I guess Golden Harvest might have it because they released it in Hong Kong. And you know, I don't know if they got any further than that. I know that's one of the reasons they never put it out, was because they wanted that alternate ending. They just wanted to get it out for that ending. Now, Stephen Barnes, the science fiction writer who used to review movies for Fighting Stars back in the early 80s, he told me on Facebook he had seen the Chinese version several times. And he said there was a little more blood in some of the fight scenes. And he described what the ending was on Facebook. And he was like, basically, Wang Yu, I guess, stabs Zatoichi, and it implies Zatoichi is weakened and falls over. And Wang Yu is also wounded, and he says something like, oh, well, we just didn't understand. We fought because we couldn't understand each other, because the a running riff in the movie is they can't understand each other at all. They just know they got to fight these bad guys. You know, he's been, Wang Yu's character has been framed for something he didn't do. So that ending does exist. It is real, but, you know, I don't know if we'll ever see it, because like a lot of the Golden Harvest stuff, okay, like, every time Man Called Tiger gets released on video, I swear it's shorter. Like every print has been shorter than what aired on Black Belt Theater in the 1980s.
Yeah.
Like that was a 90-minute movie, and the Embassy videotape was 90 minutes, and the later Fox Lorber videotape was 90 minutes, which is taken from a TV print. And but every version since on VCD, on DVD, has been like 72 minutes or 75 minutes. It's like the Golden Harvest stuff is disappearing. Mm-hmm. Like they did not preserve the longer cuts of those films. So it's a little, ever seeing that ending of Zatoichi meets his equal, I just don't think it's happening. I think the Golden Harvest stuff is so screwed up in how it was archived. They just didn't care. Like Roy Horan said, it was a bag of rice to them. They made the movie. Okay. Audience saw it. They're done.
Yeah.
You know, he claimed he slept with the print of Drunken Master under his bed for like 5 years, because otherwise like Ing Si Yun would not save it. You know, didn't care anything about it. So, because that's just how they viewed movies. And he saw a
disposable.
Video, yeah, disposable entertainment. It's like the loss of silent films. And
yeah, they just saw it as just throw it out in the theaters, and when we're done with it,
yeah,
throw in the trash. Who cares?
Who the hell is gonna watch this in 10 years?
Yeah, it's a passing fad,
right?
As the Lumiere brothers and Edison said, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And as for Wang Yu's New York appearance, I didn't go because I didn't know about it till after it happened. Of course, I would have considered it. If anything is going to get me to go to New York, it would be a Wang Yu appearance. But a local guy did go to it, and he told me that. By the way, later on, he did compete in the Thai boxing rings about a year later. But he went up to Wang Yu and he said, I got to ask you to do one thing. And he pulled up his shirt, and Wang Yu rolled up his sleeve and punched him right in the stomach. So.
And that's, you know, how Harry Houdini died.
Yes, exactly. I, you know, not what I would have done, but Wang Yu just sounds like he was one of a kind. And it was just like, they don't make them like that anymore. Back then, you had to be an alpha. So, you know. Yeah. But anyway, anything else to say about Wang Yu?
You know what, we should mention the influence, I think, of the comic books. Mm-hmm. You know, because there's a real comic book feel to, you know, I was going to mention this earlier when you said that your son really took to Wang Yu's movies. I think because, you know, you see it in Chinese Boxer and One-Armed Boxer and Flying Guillotine and a lot of the other movies, there's a comic book feel to his movies. And it, actually it goes through the Kung Fu movies in general. I think that's why a lot of the comic book artists and writers were really attracted to the genre, because it was the closest they could see to comic book superheroes
in film
at that time.
Well, Tarantino had said that he thought Master of the Flying Guillotine was like a Jack Kirby comic book, like a New Gods comic brought to life, and he's right. Mm-hmm. That is what it's like. That's the only way you could see that type of action, you know, just crazy, you know, arms reaching
stretching
off. Like Freddy Krueger or whatever, you know, just stretching arms and people fighting while walking on their hands. And, you know, just the flying guillotine itself is just a crazy fantasy weapon anyway. So, for those who are kind of new to this, it was not the first flying guillotine movie. There were actually several before this, starting at Shaw Brothers, because sometimes they're mistaken as like Master of the Flying Guillotine is the original. It's not. Right. It's Ho Ming-hwa, I think, directed the first one, like for Shaw's, which I've never been a huge fan of. But Master of the Flying Guillotine, I think it's the best of that whole genre thing, that little subgenre of flying guillotine movie. Because Carter Wong has the one where they're like the trash baskets with the blades, like throw them on their head and just pull off their head or whatever.
Is it the Fatal Flying Guillotines?
It's not that's probably the worst of all of them. the comic book influence is definitely there. I know Jimmy Wang Yu, when he was interviewed for the Knight Errant DVD, which is worth hunting down, he said that the script writer put in science fiction elements. So that's what he considered the weird stuff in his movies. Oh, that's science fiction, you know. But he claimed that he did method acting since he was playing a cab driver. He actually drove a cab
for Knight Errant.
For a couple of weeks just to get ready for the role. So I guess he really believed in method acting. I don't know if that's really true, but I don't know. It's a cool story. Jimmy, he knew cool stories to tell to the interviewers.
I really like Knight Errant. And, you know, I was thinking about this because, you know, what I said earlier about how, unlike a lot of the martial artists, all through the 70s into the mid 80s, there were Wang Yu movies getting released in the US. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like Tattoo Dragon, I mean, as decrepit as that is, that came out in like the early 80s. I think World Northall put that out. Like in 1980 or 81. And, you know, Man Called Tiger came out around that time also, and International Assassins. The one I was going to mention was Knight Errant. When that came out, that was released here in 74. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't even in the advertising for it. I mean, they billed him as Wang Yu in the credit block, but the photo in the ads is, it was called Dragon Fist, and the photos of Yuzwaki Karata.
Right. Because who's a villain in the film. He is actually in the movie, but it's like the Kung Fu Mama. She's like the villain in the film. And he said in his interview that she like ran like a herb shop or something in Taiwan. Like she wasn't even like a, you know, she wasn't some female sumo wrestler or something like that. Right. So she's ran an herb shop and taught Qigong exercises or something. So, but they cast her as this super villain where she's like a female odd job and she's run over by a car and all this nonsense, you know. But Knight Errant's a fun film. It's definitely underrated. And I said one problem was with like the fan writers of the 80s. With the exception of like Jose Emiliano and martial arts movies, that magazine, like writers seem to say, oh, Jimmy Wang Yu wasn't a real martial artist. Well, Jimmy Wang Yu, you know, he wasn't like Bruce, you know, and it's like, yeah. And it's like, well, how many of those guys were real martial artists? Like Jackie Chan wasn't a real martial artist. And most of the guys at Shaw's were not real martial artists. They learned movie fighting. And even Tarantino's like criticizing Jimmy Wang Yu's kicks. Well, he's throwing Chinese kicks, which are, they're not given a lot of, you don't cock your leg when you throw like a kung fu kick. It's kind of just the leg just kind of goes up like a whip. It's totally different from the way a Korean throws a kick or the Japanese throw their karate kicks, especially the Korean kicks. What people think is great kicking is Korean Taekwondo or Hapkido kicking. They're not thinking about what actual Chinese kicks are like, which involve just kind of bringing the foot up like a whip.
Did you know Sylvester Stallone's not a real boxer?
Yeah, exactly.
Did you know that?
Did you know Pacino is not actually in the mob that we know of?
What?
Yeah, no, Eastwood was never a cop. Can you believe that?
Are you kidding me? You mean he wasn't gunning down those people in the street?
Did you know John Wayne did not grow up on a ranch? Just grew up in a small town, like kind of a Norman Rockwell town. He was a football player and a valedictorian.
Did you know his name was Marion?
Yeah. What the hell? Like, he didn't wear a cowboy hat till he was like doing stunts on a movie set.
Yeah. Next, you're going to tell me that the John Wick movies aren't good because Keanu's not a hitman. You know?
Did you know Keanu has never taken a martial art in his life? Suppose just learn for the cinema. Just learn for the movie.
You train for the role and you do it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's what Angela Mao did. She, you know, the tournament.
Yeah.
And Hapkido and when Taekwondo strikes, she would learn each one of those for that movie.
Yeah. She would just study with Kim Jin Pai or whatever Hapkido guy they had on set and just learn how to do the kicks and everything. And because she was a Peking opera girl.
Right.
Like, you know, yeah. Cause I know Liu Feng knew her from their youth. They were both kids of the Peking opera troops. And, but Jimmy, here's the ironic thing. Jimmy's been in more fights than just about any actor I can think of. It's like, I can just do a guess and, you know, just kick out a hypothesis of how many fights he was in. And it's probably close to the truth.
Yeah. So and like, crazier, he's not a real martial artist, but he's been in more fights that are like, I am going out to hurt you fights.
Yeah.
Not like where this is a show or a demonstration.
Right.
He's been in IRL like bar fights, but he's not a real
full contact.
He's not authentic enough.
Right.
You know, never mind that he like injured himself flying a hang glider on Man from Hong Kong.
And it got apparently enough of the cast pissed off at him that Roger Ward, the wrestler, wanted to like shoot on him on set and choke him out, just teach him a lesson. So he'd knock all his Angry Man stuff out. And Ryan Trenchard Smith was like, no, don't do anything to him.
So, yeah.
But yeah, he could be a tough dude. So it's like, I don't know what people are looking for when they try to say, oh, he's not a real martial artist.
They're just trying to promote their guy, you know?
Yeah.
And so when somebody goes, well, here's this guy, they go, but he's not as good as this guy that I've got the Bruce Lee as a DJ t-shirt.
And, right, right. Like, yeah, they do the George Tan. He's not as good as Bruce. You know.
Yeah.
Bruce really gave it to him. He gave the audience what they wanted. You know.
Bruce has the advantage of dying young and people projecting all their hopes and dreams onto him.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. It's the strangest thing for a lifestyle that's supposed to promote health. And yet they picked the most unhealthy guy who was ever in the film business to represent. and Wang Yu, meanwhile, lives a pretty long life. I mean, the guy, you know, lived a long life and, you know, quite a legacy, I think. I think any of these writers that write him off is like he was a phony or whatever. It's like, first of all, they do a disservice to the genre they're writing about. And it's actually, to me, it's very dishonest film writing. It's like incredibly dishonest.
It kind of reminds me of, this is probably a little bit, this maybe isn't a great comparison, but it kind of reminds me of in music journalism, how music writers will, maybe journalism is the wrong word, but people who write about music will find a niche. And from that niche, we attack the adjacent genres or band or whatever artists to promote our thing. You know, punk is really great because it saved us from prog rock. You know, and every right. documentary we see, we're going to show footage of Emerson, Lake, and Palmer to show you what pompous asses these musicians
Rick
were.
Rick Wakeman in his cape.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you'll see like, you know, Emerson flipping up and around on his piano, you know, but punk saved us from that and from virtuosity and blah, blah, blah. So it's like, you know, Bruce saved martial arts movies, you know, and so anything that's inconvenient to that narrative, you know, you find ways to poke holes in it because you're kind of
mm-hmm.
staking your claim as the narrative I'm promoting is Bruce Lee saved martial arts movies, you know, and saved action movies and also gave, you know, Asian people representation in movies and, you know, there's all these, and he invented MMA too and hip hop music.
That's right.
and killed off the Western also. That's another one that gets.
Oh, I haven't heard that one. Maybe that's a new one.
The Kung Fu movies came in and replaced the Western.
Oh, they saved us from the Western. Is that what they really mean? They saved us?
You could go back to the early 60s, well, to 1960, really, and see Western television shows that had judo and samurai characters and everything. I mean, the Western just did everything first and then retired.
Yeah.
It wasn't replaced. Yeah, exactly.
That was an exhausted genre. It really was. The Western had
exhausted.
It's been
around since the camera could roll. It was like, mm-hmm. let's get a guy riding a horse, you know?
Yep. Yeah. And I often think like Kung Fu films is an exhausted genre. I think that you got every good quality film you're ever going to get out of that because the filmmakers coming along today, they don't have that type of training. They don't have that type of background. Mm-hmm. They don't have that type of understanding that Lau Kar-Lung had or Yen Wu-Ping, because those were like the last action movie makers. They didn't come from film school. They came from the sets. They grew up on the sets. They're really like blue collar guys. They're like the last blue collar directors. And I'm talking Yen Wu-Ping and Lau Kar-Lung and anybody else who had some martial arts experience or set experience growing up on the set. Kind of like Sergio Leone. He was just a guy who grew up on the set. He wasn't like, mm-hmm. didn't go to film school, just learned on the set.
Yeah. And that's the way the old studio system was. You learned your trade.
Yeah. I think there's something to say about that type of raw talent. And yeah, Wang Yu, same thing. I don't think he went to film school. I think he just learned on the set.
This is the whole premise of Carducci's,
and in bar fights,
Carducci's stone mail.
Right.
These are stone mails, you know.
Yeah. He was like, I'm gonna tell Joe. I said Wang Yu's gotta be considered stone mail.
He's a stone mail. Yeah.
If he dives, there's no doubt about it. In fact, that should be the episode title, Wang Yu. R.I.P. Stone Mail.
Yes.
Stone mail of Hong Kong. Got to put
the stone mail of Hong Kong. Yes. Mm-hmm. Just an observation, Chris, mm-hmm. you said he wanted to have his name be spelled Wong, W-O-N-N-G, on Wikipedia. I'm seeing the surname for all of his children is Wong.
Oh.
So I don't know. There's that.
He's going to rise up from the grave and knock us around.
We call
the name he's credited for on posters.
If we don't put it as Wong on YouTube and Podbean, it's going to.
As long as you say Jimmy Wong Yu, everybody knows who it is.
So. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Cause there's only one of those.
Yeah. Then they might think you know, we're talking about the guy from, you know, Dirty Ho or.
Right. Know, right.
Right. Yeah.
Yep.
Now, what about getting back to the Zatoichi and the one-armed swordsman? I always had a real strong spaghetti Western. I think the end of that movie really brings in the spaghetti Western influence. The final confrontation, I just get a real vibe off of that.
They were picking up that influence. It's obviously works. I'll watch like Tomisaburo Wakayama movies. Mm-hmm. He's Katsu's brother. Yeah. That is frequently mistaken for Katsu by certain people I won't name. but he did this series of films, The Wicked Priest. They're total spaghetti Western knockoffs. It's stunning. And like, they have raunchy humor and everything. And then they have like the spaghetti Western riffs all throughout them. Even the music is scored like a spaghetti Western. I mean, if you watch the original Baby Cart series, the soundtrack scores are total wannabe Morricone type of soundtracks, or Riz Ortolani or somebody. but yeah, obviously those were doing big business in Japan and were inspiring those filmmakers to kind of, I guess, hip up their samurai movies quite a bit. Because one thing I've kind of noticed reading up more and more about this stuff as more info becomes available, like, the films we always think are real classy, like the Baby Cart films, they're considered trash in Japan. Kazuo Kuoki he's considered like a garbage writer. Like, he writes porn garbage or whatever, you know, along with some cool superhero shows like Digit Zaboga. But he's just like, his comic book work, like Crying Freeman and all that stuff, it's like pornography. And when you're reading the Baby Cart comic books, Lone Wolf and Cub, I mean, they're X-rated. What's funny is that
I remember pulling getting those, you know, being at Borders and being in the manga section back when that was a burgeoning thing, and seeing the Crying Freeman comics and pulling them off and going, this is porn. You know?
I collected every issue, Hunter. Yeah. But yeah, it was amazing what they got away with.
Yeah, the Christoph Gans film is remarkably chaste.
Yes, it's a very nice, it's a very Catholic version. Yeah. Crying Freeman. It's funny because I've noticed that type of manga doesn't seem to get released over here anymore. Like, I was a little shocked when I picked up a volume of Devilman. I've always wanted to read it since I was a kid, hearing about it, but Go Nagai's original Devilman manga. And there's some nudity in there, but it never gets too raunchy. It's not even, you know, the cartoon they did, which was considered like almost like a PG-13 or R-rated level TV cartoon in the early 70s. Is not nearly as raunchy as the manga is, which I think it was aimed at like 10-year-old boys or something. That's the funny thing. So it's just different standards there. But but with the spaghetti Western influence on those samurai films, you could definitely see it like late 60s. And I mean, just thinking back to the Laserdisc days, the videotape days, what was the one country you could always get the letterbox copies of the spaghetti Westerns, like Great Silence or whatever Alex Cox would talk about on that Macaroni Westerns blog? It was always Japan. Yeah. That was the country that loved spaghetti Westerns, like more than a millennial on Hunter's Facebook page. So, I think Hunter would agree. But yeah, there was definitely an influence.
Yep.
And Eric's sometimes asking me about certain samurai stuff, and now he's hunting down all these obscure samurai TV shows that apparently have some spaghetti influence. So there will be more info about that type of stuff probably in the coming years.
Yeah. Bounty Hunter. That's another one, right? That was a Wakayama show. Yeah.
Yeah. Bounty Hunter. And and I think it's total like spaghetti Western formula.
And Mute Samurai, which started out as Hideo Gosha and Shintaro Katsu wanted to do a remake of The Great Silence. And they couldn't they couldn't get the rights because Clint Eastwood had purchased the worldwide remake rights to The Great Silence and just never did anything with them. So they said, well, we'll just do a TV show and rip off the idea. And that's how Mute Samurai came about.
Hey, that's how Cinema City did Dragon from Russia, ripping off Crying Freeman. They just made the movie that they settled out of court with the manga publisher. Got the rights for a peak suit for it. So. You know, but yeah, and also with Wang Yu's own stuff, the spaghetti Western, when you watch things like even Point the Finger of Death, the Italian Western influence is definitely there. Like everybody was digging those things back then. I forgot to ask Liu Feng if the Terrence Hill and Bud Spencer movies were popular in Hong Kong, because I think those were a huge influence on the Kung Fu comedies, because they're always using Trinity music. And, you know, you'll watch some Goldig film with Cao Fei and, you know, John Chang. And it's like, there's the Trinity music right there, or the My Name is Nobody music, you know, and how many films have stolen that title for their English, their anglicized, you know, retitlings or whatever.
Right.
There's His Name is Nobody. And, you know, it goes on and on.
Yeah. Well, there were those Trinity influenced. I always thought those like the Low Lee movies, the, mm-hmm. those comedies, the Superman Out West or whatever. I mean, those always seem like Trinity knockoffs to me.
Plus the Italians used the sound effects in the 60s that totally influenced the way they were doing Foley work and sound effects in Hong Kong later on. Right. So guys, anything else to say about the man of the hour, Jimmy Wang Yu?
I think that's it for me. RIP, you know, he was one of my introductions to Shaw Brothers movies, and you know, he's always had a special place for me. So I was really sad to hear when he died. I always love hearing stories about him because he was a real character, and he definitely an important figure in the landscape of cinema that isn't probably appreciated as much as he should be today.
Yep,
definitely. So, Chris, do you have anything to plug? You want to plug the book for the umpteenth time? As you're probably doing on podcasts every other week and every local appearance in New Jersey.
Library appearances and the book is out. It's been out since January. These Fists Break Bricks. And hopefully there'll be documentaries also and all sorts of other These Fists Break Bricks products and so on. Mouse pads and mugs and t-shirts and
cereal.
I'm kidding. Right.
You're great to go do a signing at the Dirt Mall that we saw in Mallrats. Is that going to happen?
I'm going to be in Albany showing Sister Street Fighter. And then I'll be with Grady at the Mahoning Drive-In showing Enter the Dragon. And I'm not sure what other.
Have fun sitting through Enter the Dragon again, Chris, for the 5,000th time.
Well, I'm going to be looking for Tadashi Yamashita now.
Well, yeah, he's in the O'Hara footage. I can tell you right now.
Thank you for that.
I spotted him in the letterbox version right away. I was like, he's in the little. Oh, this is O'Hara, his bodyguard. And there's Tadashi doing, you know, some breaking tricks on Bob Wall. So
that right there is a reason enough to watch it again for me.
I showed it to my son about a month ago, and I said, this is the final time I'm watching this damn thing. I'm watching the Criterion, Warner Brothers, 1973 cut. That's it. I'm never sitting through this damn thing again, you know. So we'll see how long I can keep that promise.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thanks. Thanks again for having me on.
Sure.
This was great.
Good to
great
have you
fun.
Back.
Thank you.
All right. Well, with that, I'm going to say adios.
Hey, peace out.
Good night.
And now it's time for Rue Britannia with your foreign correspondent, the Nez.
In a move that will surprise nobody other than Jada Pinkett Smith's gynecologist, Conservative MP for Wakefield Imran Ahmed was convicted this week of sexually assaulting a 15-year-old boy. No surprise, he was merely following the low moral example of his false prophet. Having already been sufficiently embarrassed enough, the Conservative Party now faces the inevitability of a messy by-election campaign in the constituency. Tories in trouble. Undeterred by the complete lack of any shame, Ahmed has decided to appeal. Best of luck. Convicted sex offenders do need to be segregated in prison. Speaking of lags and trouble with John Law, Boris Johnson received a fine of £50 this week for breaching laws concerning social gatherings during the two-year pandemic. His Chancellor Rishi Sunak also picked up a fine of £50, though since his wife is an Indian billionaire, she's basically paying his fine in kilograms. Nothing screams the party of law and order quite like a party of rapists and COVID spreaders. Community relations, and it's been another bad week for the Muslim immigrant community as a Somali immigrant was convicted of murdering Conservative MP Sir David Amos after a visit to a local hardware store went horribly wrong after purchasing a pack of bread knives. Still, we can't be beastly to the Muslims, so you better move along since there's nothing here to see going on whatsoever at all. Meanwhile, another Muslim on a UK passport was convicted of ISIS membership in a courtroom in Virginia. Love thy neighbour? No thanks. I'd rather be happy if my neighbours were a chapel of axe-throwing bikers. Paranormal activity. And in a move that the media didn't see coming this week, Harry Markle and his wife, Evita Peron, made a secret visit to meet the Queen at Windsor Castle. Once pleasantries were dispensed, the pair left their combined order of 2 Domino's vegetarian pizzas, 3 boxes of dough balls, and a Diet Coke, got back on their mopeds, and buggered off into the night. Let them eat cake? Maybe. Though on the other hand, maybe it's spicy salsa. Further notes in passing, ITV announced plans to revive Big Brother in the summertime. Why stop there? Why not just basically revive the Iraq War and complete the set? The Home Office passes measures indicating that civil servants must now basically state their pronouns. Usually it was furry cap and hot dog. And the government announces plans to repatriate illegal immigrants to Rwanda. A shame. I was rather hoping they were going to be shit-canned to Mars. And finally, when not too busy spending time at IDon'tGiveAShitAboutYou.com, the Prime Minister's sister has doubled down on her insistence that Russia has won the war in the Ukraine and that the Ukrainians should sue for peace. Quote unquote. Everybody knows it's over, so why don't they just step over the bodies in the mass graves and just stop annoying me, bemoaned Rachel Johnson, Boris Johnson's dumber sister, as opposed to his dumber brother, or indeed his dumber father. I have no idea what the collective term is for the term cunts, although I am open to suggestions. My suggestion is shower, as in Boris Johnson comes from a shower of
thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to Stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to Facebook.com. Type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.